here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 60 and clear. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low in the low 40s. Then tomorrow, cloudy with a high in the mid-40s. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with a low in the mid-30s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 3 p.m.
If it's in Texas, it's in Texas Monthly. Howdy, welcome to our program. I'm KC Jobe, and this is Texas Monthly Magazine on site and to sound broadcasting. The first article will be from our brand new March issue. As always, we're going to open this issue with our letter from the editor. This was entitled Fans of the Cowdogs. It's from Dan Goodgame, the editor-in-chief. If you want to write to the editor, you can write him at roar@texasmonthly.com for email. And like I said, the title of this month's column, Fans of the Cowdogs. Associate editor Christian Wallace, the author of this issue's cover story, first laid eyes on John R. Erickson, creator of Hank the Cowdog, when the author delivered a reading in Christian's hometown of Andrew in West Texas. Christian was about five at the time in 1993, and several elements of that encounter seared themselves into his tender memory. For one thing, the reading was held at the local amphitheater. The rustic venue, located in an old Caliche rock pit, had to be cleared of rattlesnakes before the arrival of about 450 fans. Then, the day before the event, Erickson got kicked in the head by a Mustang he was training on his ranch in the panhandle, so he showed up in Andrews with stitches in his face. Finally, he told his stories in the voices of Hank and Pete the Barn Cat and other denizens of his fictional world. His performance was periodically interrupted by dramatic lightning and booming thunder from a nearby storm. Christian's fondest memory was of his dad, Scott, crafting the show's stage decorations, human-sized cardboard cutouts of Hank and the other characters. After Erickson's performance, the Hank cutout found a home in Christian's bedroom and enjoyed frequent trips outdoors to join in games with the neighborhood kids. In contrast to the school-issued storybooks that showed snowy scenes and verdant forests, Hank was ours, Christian said. The landscape was familiar, as was Erickson's depiction of the ranching life and the critters and the accents in the recordings. A few years later, in Seattle, a second grader named Lauren Larson was introduced to Hank through books brought home by parents who had no ties to the Lone Star State but were fans of several Texas writers, including Larry McMurtry. I thought everybody had Hank, said Lauren, and who knows, maybe he subtly influenced her choice to focus on agriculture as a beat when she was in journalism school. Lauren went on to work at Chicago Magazine and at GQ in New York City. We recruited her to Texas Monthly in February of last year to edit mostly long-form features such as this month's cover story. Like many fans of Hank tales, Lauren has found them soothing amid all our current anxieties, and working on Christian's story had a similar effect. I enjoyed getting an inside look at Erickson, she says, and at the values that come through in his stories underneath the humor. Values that transcend anyone's political views. Christian first pitched a story about Erickson and Hank 5 years ago, but says he couldn't drum up much interest until he had two more of the author's fans on the staff, Lauren and me. My wife and I were introduced to Hank and company more than two decades ago when our sons were young, and a friend gave us a box full of cassette tapes of Erickson reading his handiwork. The discursive style of storytelling matched the one I'd grown up hearing in Mississippi. All of us quickly developed a fondness for Hank and his world. We were living in Connecticut at the time. Those tapes got us through long road trips for camping vacations and visits to relatives across the South. Every dog we've had since then has been designated the head of the ranch security, and each has learned the hard way, just like Hank, that in this life you don't always get your eggs scrambled. I hope you enjoyed Christian's profile, the cover and story layout with design director Emily Kimbrough and art director Victoria Milner, and the rest of this issue of Texas Monthly. We turn now to that feature article and the cover story about Hank the Cowdog's author. It's entitled King of the Canine Cannon. John R. Erickson wanted to write the great American novel. Generations of readers only wanted one thing, more Hank. This is by Christian Wallace. Out on the range, rattlesnakes don't bother John R. Erickson much. They're part of life on the M Cross Ranch, Erickson's home and working cattle operation in the rough country of the northeastern Texas panhandle. But the rattler under the porch of his riding cabin is a different story. They're good at killing mice, he mutters, grabbing his Ruger 22 pistol, but they're also good at killing cow dogs. Erickson knows from experience. A few years ago, he lost a pup named Bones to a snake bite. Doesn't intend to let that happen again, which is why one morning in July, the
77-year-old rider lowers himself onto his belly until he is eye level with an unhappy coontail rattlesnake. Erickson rose early this morning, as he has almost every day for 54 years, to write, or as he likes to say, to pull the plow. At 5:30 a.m., he made the short drive from his house to the one-room cabin that he uses as an office. His headlights shone in the pre-dawn dark, and his two dogs, Rosie, a red heeler, bounding with energy, and Daisy, a sweet yellow lab with the age-stiffened gait, picked their way through tall grass and burned-out cedars alongside the pickup. At the cabin, Erickson made some coffee, then he got to work. Some mornings, work might mean scribbling replies to fan mail, piles of it, at the folding table that serves as his desk. Other days, he might jot some notes in his journal, but more often than not, he spends the next 4 or 5 hours sunk deep into a faded, dust-covered armchair, pecking at the keyboard of his laptop. He works on articles for livestock journals, essays for various websites, and nonfiction books about ranching, cowboying, Texas history, wildfires, and panhandle archaeology. And twice a year, as the sun eases over the eastern rim of Pickett Canyon, Erickson types these words: "It's me again, Hank the Cowdog." That sentence, one of the most compelling in literature to anyone who's been a third grader in Texas in the past 30 years, has begun 75 books and counting of the children's series, Hank the Cowdog, which is narrated by an Australian shepherd who tells of his misadventures as the self-deputized head of ranch security. Hank takes the job and himself very seriously, but the truth is he's often more bluster than brains. It's very subtle humor. Half the time the narrator is lying, Erickson tells me, and the other half he doesn't know what he's talking about because he's a dingbat. When I was growing up in Andrews in West Texas, Hank was a local celebrity. I remember him keeping watch from the posters at my elementary school and at the Andrews County Library. He was a regular passenger on our family road trips. My parents would pop in a Hank audiobook on cassette, and my brothers and I would pause the backseat bloodshed long enough to laugh at the antics of Hank and his chicken-hearted sidekick, Drover. Drover's hoarse-voiced catchphrase, "Oh, my leg," which he deploys anytime hard work or danger is near, was a running family joke. When Erickson came to Andrews to give a reading, hundreds packed the amphitheater, braving a lightning storm for the chance to hear him do the voices of all the characters who populated the world he had so vividly imagined. Hank and Grover, Pete the Barn Cat, Slim Chance the Bachelor Cowboy, Riff and Snort, Coyote Brothers, and Junior, a banjo-picking buzzer. The books were exciting, chock-full of adventures and capers to crack. Who murdered Sally Mae's chickens? Is this corn cob truly priceless? Is the moon really made of chopped chicken liver? But more importantly to me, Hank was the only series I had read that was set in my neck of the woods, or rather, my lack of the woods. Growing up surrounded by treeless alfalfa farms and oil fields, I found Hank's home on a cattle ranch in Ochiltree County a lot more familiar than Narnia or Hogwarts. Reading Hank, I felt for the first time that life in rural Texas could be funny and thrilling and worth writing about. Hank was ours. Since Hank and Grover made their debut in 1983, the series has sold some 9.5 million copies and continues to be in brisk demand at bookstores and libraries. Hank has been translated into Chinese, Danish, Farsi, Spanish, and, as of last year, Latin. There have been stage, television, and radio adaptations, and whenever Erickson makes live appearances, kids and their parents line up to hear him read from the books and to sing along to the original songs that Erickson writes to go with them. Classes include "Cats Are Stupid," "Me Just a Worthless Coyote," and "Never Rope a Cow from the Hood of a Pickup." In the early terrifying days of the pandemic, Erickson's small team at Maverick Books, the press he owns, uploaded a soothing YouTube video of the author reading from the first Hank book. "The human race has seen some really tough times," he tells me. "I'm just snowflakes landing on a Sherman tank, but I try to bring light and joy and a sense of order into the little world that I inhabit." Hundreds of thousands of listeners turned to Hank for a pandemic distraction late last year when the Cowdog made his podcast debut. With Matthew McConaughey voicing Hank, the Hank the Cowdog podcast climbed to number 10 on the Apple podcast charts. Parents tuned in with their kids, hungry for some entertainment that was family-friendly and screen-free. "I wanted to do the podcast and voice Hank because it's wily and wholesome at the same time, full of values, common sense, loyalty, and good humor," McConaughey wrote to me in an email. "Not only do my kids enjoy it, Hank admirers from all over America, and especially Texas, have reached out to me with collective applause." Now, as Hank might say, back to that rattlesnake, On a summer morning when I pay him a visit, Erickson's writing routine has been interrupted by Rosie and Daisy, who are outside on sniff patrol, sounding the snake alarm. Erickson steps out onto the porch. There's an ominous buzz beneath him, rattling. Daisy is doing her best to evict the intruder, and that makes Erickson nervous. He unholsters his pistol and eases his way onto the ground. Sweat glistens at his temples where a nest of unruly gray hair meets his cropped white sideburns. He wears rimless glasses and a faded denim pearl snap shirt. White chest hair sprout over the top snap like a bouquet of barbed wire. The snake's buzzing sounds grow louder. Stretched out flat on the earth, Erickson grips the gun with both hands and leans forward on his forearms to steady his aim. His target is now in a striking position, but Erickson takes his time. He fires two shots. The rattle goes quiet. He picks himself up and turns to me. "If you can get him out from there," he says, "you're welcome to keep him." I may have mentioned my fondness for barbecued snake. I grab a hoe resting against the wall and drag the scaly, rope-like carcass from under the porch. It's a decent-sized western diamondback, about 4 feet long. Erickson's second shot has nearly taken its head off, and he finishes the job with an old-timer knife he pulls from his pocket. Then he goes to work, burying the head so that Daisy won't wind up with a surprise from one of the still-loaded fangs. The day before, when I arrived at the M-Cross, about 100 miles northeast of Amarillo, Erickson drove out to Hank's Road to guide me the rest of the way to ranch headquarters. I was glad he did. Hank's Road, an unpaved one-laner, is the last main road before a narrower caliche path drops off the cap rock into a maze of valleys and mesas. When I pulled up to Erickson's truck, his window was rolled down. Rosie poked her head out, her tongue wagging hello. Seeing the author for the first time with his real-life cow dog brought to mind all those illustrations I'd seen of Hank and Erickson's fictional alter ego, Slim Chance. Hank's longtime illustrator, a fellow Perryton native named Gerald L. Holmes, had used Erickson as his model for Slim since he drew sketches for the very first book. Erickson no longer wore the wispy chin whiskers that Slim sports, but his brown eyes and straw hat remained the same. "Well, come on then," Erickson said after our introductions, adding that his wife Chris had tamales waiting for us back at their house. With that, he was bucketing down the Caliche Road, Rosie at his side and a cloud of dust trailing him. It was exactly the kind of scene that fans of the books have spent years imagining when they think of the writer at home, a rancher in his pickup with his cow dog by his side. But such a life wasn't inevitable. In fact, if things had worked out the way Erickson had hoped they would 5 decades ago, there would likely be no ranch, no truck, and no Hank. A little sidebar here real quick. Wisdom from the Book of Hank. When time marches on, it steps on your nose and tail and leaves boot prints down your back. There's no crime in thinking about a crime. This is still America. When you're big and ferocious, it's hard to make a small impression. Being scared of scary things is normal behavior. Don't take anything for granted. That's what tombstones are made of. The actual truth often lies hidden beneath the facts. If you start off on the wrong foot, the footer you go, the wronger it gets. If you're good to eat, the world is a dangerous place. The element of surprise can be very surprising when the other guy uses it first. In this life, you don't always get your eggs scrambled. Back to our text. The afternoon of my arrival, once we've eaten and Erickson has taken his post-prandial nap, we set out for his hometown, Perryton, about 40 miles north of his ranch and just about spitting distance from the Oklahoma state line. Erickson climbs into his Chevy Colorado, which beneath a thick coat of red dust, I'm sure, is white. Rosie hops in after him, scattering junk mail and empty pouches of Red Man chewing tobacco. Half-filled spit bottle sits in the console. Nothing is out of the ordinary for a truck in rural Texas, with one exception. When Erickson starts the engine, the speakers boom with the sound of, well, Morten Lauridsen, Erickson says. He writes contemporary choral music. That's the last thing I expected to hear, I tell him. I was listening to Wagner before Bob Wills, he says. He inherited his love of classical music from his father, Joe. I don't like rock and roll, and I hardly listen to the news. When he's driving, Erickson is listening either to choral music or to one of the Hank audiobooks, all of which he voices himself. The stories still make him laugh. In Perryton, he drives down a quiet neighborhood street, parks in front of a yellow two-story house with a concrete porch and brick-red shingles, his childhood home. He didn't grow up wanting to be a writer, he says. No famous author had ever sprouted from the fields surrounding Perryton, fields that once gave his corner of the state bragging rights as the wheat heart of the country. It seemed nearly insane to produce a writer in a place with no bookstore, Erickson says. We didn't know it was possible. From his mother, Ann Beth Curry Erickson, he inherited a love of storytelling. She would tell him, his older brother, and his younger sister about their family history, which went back five generations in Texas. Some of the tales were gruesome. In 1860, for instance, Erickson's great-great-grandmother, Martha Sherman, was murdered in a Comanche raid about 100 miles south of Wichita Falls. Her son, a Shakespeare-quoting cowboy named Joe Sherman, was among the first to run cattle on the Llano Estacado. In 1890, he registered the brand Erickson uses today, the M-Cross. Joe Sherman also met a violent end. 1917, a neighbor shot him over a disputed watering hole. His mother's plain-spoken narratives were more interesting to Erickson than the hundreds of books his parents crammed into their home. He was a slow reader, and few authors held his interest. The one exception was Mark Twain. Twain's novels, especially those featuring Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn, were packed with adventure and wordplay, and best of all, Twain was funny. Most of the time, Erickson preferred to be playing pirates or Alamo with the neighborhood boys, but his best friend was a mutt named Frisky. Frisky and I shared a bedroom on the second floor of our old house on Amherst, Erickson writes in a 2018 book, Finding Hank. When Frisky and I were alone, I talked to him just as though he were a person, and I felt that he understood and talked back with his eyes, ears, and tail. As a high school freshman, Erickson started working on a farm and ranch outside Perryton. He learned to brand cattle, fix windmills, and plug his ears with wads of paper to muffle the roar of tractor engines. He wasn't a brilliant student, but he sang in the a cappella choir, played bassoon in the band, acted in plays, and started at center on the varsity football team. His lanky build, 6 feet, 155 pounds, made him an odd fit for the offensive line and earned him a nickname, Slim. It was in my senior year that I did my first creative writing and began to suspect that I might have a talent, Erickson writes in Finding Hank. His English teacher, Annie Love, who had been tasked with making Chaucer palatable to panhandle footballers, asked each of her students to write an original poem. When Erickson turned in his verse, Love told him it was beautiful and asked him to write more. He spent the rest of the semester staying up late, listening to Bach, and scribbling poetry for Love. Decades later, he would dedicate a Hank book to her. But the writing bug didn't quite stick to his college years. In 1962, he moved away from Perryton for the first time to attend the University of Denver. There, Erickson threw himself into the civil rights movement. He sold his gun collection to pay for a bus ticket to Mississippi. It was a pretty scary place to be, Erickson says, recalling the bullet holes pocking the windows of the Jackson NAACP office. But it was an opportunity to educate ourselves and maybe put a little pressure on the people who ran the state of Mississippi. The group of white, black activists with whom Erickson traveled met both Governor Ross Barnett and civil rights leader Medgar Evers. It was quite a contrast. Medgar Evers was assassinated 3 months later in his front yard. He learned of Evers' murder while working at a church in East Harlem over summer break. He loved New York City. With all its noise and soot and shoving crowds, its rainbow of cultures and the hubris of its architecture, he would later write. But at the end of the summer, he returned to Texas to begin his sophomore year at the University of Texas in Austin. He grew his hair and, quote, a defiant little beard. He traded his denim jacket for a lavender turtleneck and his Wranglers for chinos. He also met Christine Dykema, a sophomore home economics major from Dallas, at an event for his doomed campaign for a position in the Student Senate. A classmate, one Kinky Freeman, also lost his beard that year. Erickson managed to woo Chris by casting her in a dance drama he had written. By the time we got that done, Chris's other boyfriends were getting a busy signal, Erickson says with a sly grin. After graduating from UT in 1966, Erickson considered going into the ministry because he had enjoyed working with underprivileged youths at churches and at the YMCA. But he also felt an intellectual itch. He was accepted into a graduate program at Harvard Divinity School. In Boston, he led a bohemian life, subsisting on boiled turkey necks and chicken gizzards, cheap and hearty staples that would show up later in his books as Slim Chance's primary diet. Playing P. Pete Seeger songs on his banjo and running around the city with a book tucked under his arm. But Erickson's life was about to take a turn. I've heard about this fiction writing course that had a reputation as being the course you wanted to get into if you could, Erickson tells me. Recent alumni included John Updike and Norman Mailer. Though Erickson had never taken a fiction class before, he submitted a writing sample and was one of 15 students admitted. He began to think this writing was more than a passing fancy. Later that year, in August 1967, he married Chris, and she moved across the country to be with him. All of a sudden, I was no longer a carefree bachelor who could sleep in a dumpster, howl at the moon, stay out all night, and dash off a poem once or twice a month, Erickson later wrote. I had joined my life to a woman who had high standards and who expected me to do something with my life. Although Erickson felt that writing seemed like a pretty flimsy profession, he figured he had to give it a shot. One of the first decisions I made was, I'd better get serious about writing and find out if I can do this or not, Erickson tells me. And if Chris had not supported that idea, it never would have happened. But she seemed to have some secret wisdom or knowledge that this was what I was supposed to do. One wintry night, 1967, Erickson had an epiphany. He was walking through Harvard Yard. Light snow was falling. He stopped beneath the lamplight and looked around, suddenly aware that he did not and never would belong there. I've been anxious to get away from the panhandle and everything it stood for, Erickson says. I tried. But then I woke up to the fact that I would never be part of what Harvard was. I had wanted to wash Texas off and be one of those people, an intellectual who moved through the halls of academia with ease. But somehow it didn't work. 3 course hours short of finishing his degree, Erickson and his wife loaded up their belongings and came home to Texas. Back home in Perryton, a long way from the small independent presses in Austin and far, far from the coastal publishing hubs, Erickson knew he would have to work even harder at his craft to make a living. His ambition only grew. He dreamed of defining a literary generation like Hemingway or Faulkner had. He chased literary agents around hotel lobbies. He hobnobbed with editors at conferences. He wrote query letters and sent out manuscripts. He was rebuffed at every turn. I started off pasting my rejection slips on the wall. Erickson says in a 2016 documentary, I was confident by the time I covered one wall, I would get something accepted. Well, when I covered the entire office with rejection slips, it wasn't funny anymore, so I tore them down and burned them. By the winter of 1982, Erickson was 39 years old and had been trying to make it big as a novelist for 15 years. To keep his family afloat, he attended bar at the Perryton Golf Club, worked at a feedlot, part-timed as a handyman, hawked a board game he invented called Blitz Chess, and for 8 years eked out a living as a working cowboy while he collected those refusals. But the cattle market had crashed a year before in 1981, and though he had since found work as a carpenter's helper, Erickson was nearly broke. He had 2 young children by then, with another on the way. Family was living in a small house in Perryton. Chris drove a beat-to-hell Ford Pinto and hadn't bought a new dress in years, but there were glimmers of hope. His prose had started to change. Instead of trying to mimic the writers on the bestseller list, nowadays, he describes those early efforts as hopeless, depressing, existential, postmodern flatdoodle. He'd started to write in the style his cowboy companion used when they told stories at roundups and spring brandings. He had discovered his cowboy voice and was beginning to find a small audience. Livestock Weekly had given him a column about his life on horseback. University of Nebraska Press had published 2 of his books about cowboying, and then he thought he'd gotten his biggest break yet, when, at the Western Writers of America Conference, he met Irwin Applebaum, an editor at Bantam Books, which published the best-selling Western author of all time. Louis L'Amour was at the end of his life, and he'd been the workhorse for Bantam Books, Erickson says. He sold about 100 million copies for them, and they were beginning to wonder what they were going to do after Louis died or couldn't write anymore. So I got acquainted with his editor. I thought it looked pretty promising that I was very close to getting a contract with Bantam. One brutally cold day with 8 inches of snow on the ground, Erickson shivered his way through his carpentry work until he could get home to check the mailbox as he did every evening. That night, there was a letter from Bantam Books inside. He ripped it open. The letter began, "We're sorry to inform you." Erickson felt the world fall away beneath him. "I'd gone through hundreds of rejection letters," he said, "but that one was a killer." He woke up early the next morning to write, but he didn't feel right. He was lightheaded and dizzy. He went back to bed and slept for 24 hours straight. He had horrible dreams. He was wounded, struggling to trudge through snow, a crimson trail of blood in his wake. He's being followed by yellow-eyed wolves. I actually thought I might die, he recalls. Instead, he got up early again the next morning, 4:30 a.m. He went to his writing office nearby, opened his journal, and made a decision that would change his life. After Erickson shows me his childhood home, we drive about a block and a half and pull up to a detached two-car garage. Cream paint is flaking off the building and weeds are growing through cracks in the driveway. Kind of run down, Erickson says, shrugging. We are at the birthplace of Hank the Cowdog. This garage was where Erickson went that winter morning in 1982 after he received the rejection letter from Louis L'Amour's editor. With those dreams of yellow-eyed wolves still fresh in his mind, he ran some numbers. His total income from writing over the last 15 years came to about $3,000. Calculating 4 hours of work a day, he figured he'd earned about 13 cents an hour. He recognized that his early stuff hadn't been very good, but he was certain that his more recent work deserved a wider audience. He knew that if he hadn't figured something out, he would be forced to quit riding just as he had been forced to quit cowboying when the cattle market tanked. That morning, Erickson decided to throw a Hail Mary. I didn't need the approval of editors or agents in New York, he says. I needed readers. He'd print his own dang books. This, of course, was before the internet enabled anyone who can upload a file to grow a wide audience as a self-published author. To make matters worse, Texas was suffering the toughest oil bust in state history, and almost all of the few small presses in Texas were going belly up. Nevertheless, with the support of his father and Chris, Erickson borrowed $2,000 from a foolish banker, as he calls him, and founded Maverick Books. He turned his garage into company headquarters, found a printer in Michigan, and sent off a manuscript. On September 1st, 1982, he went to the freight dock in Perryton and picked up 1,600 copies of The Devil in Texas and Other Cowboy Tales. The book was a collection of wry short stories about ranch life in the Panhandle. Some stories recounted his days in the saddle. Others veered toward the fantastic and philosophical. One imagines Satan challenging two cowpokes to a roping contest, to which one cowboy responds, "Hell against Texas is a normal day around here." Erickson placed ads for the book in Livestock Weekly, in which he listed his home phone number and address for direct sales. Then he went on the road, peddling copies of The Devil in Texas at rodeos, feed stores, 4-H auctions, saddle shops, goat ropings, county fairs. There was indeed an audience for the kind of Western stories Erickson wrote. The same readers who bought Louis L'Amour were now buying John R. Erickson. The first run of The Devil in Texas sold out quickly. Erickson ordered a second printing, and that sold out too. By Christmas, Maverick Books had sold some 5,000 copies of the book for the tune of $35,000. Tucked away among the 14 stories in The Devil in Texas was one called Confessions of a Cowdog. It had first appeared in the June 1981 issue of The Cattleman. Earlier that year, Erickson had been contracted to write 12 articles for a Fort Worth-based magazine. When he had run out of ideas, he decided it might be fun to try writing from the perspective of a well-meaning but meddlesome Australian shepherd, Hank, that he had known on a ranch near Forgan, Oklahoma. I didn't consider the first Hank story the best of those that were in The Devil in Texas, Erickson says. When he did readings, he most often read a story called Diary of a Bronc. But one day he switched things up and read Confessions of a Cowdog to the Rotary Club in Perryton. The audience just roared with laughter, he says. After the program, a local optometrist came trotting out and said, "John, you need to do more of that dog." Erickson was surprised. "It never occurred to me there was anything special about that story," he says. But when he read the cowdog story to other groups, he kept hearing the same thing. More Hank. Erickson wasn't sure he could stretch the cowdog idea beyond the story he'd already written, but given the warm reception, he figured he would try it. Giving Hank his own short novel. He wrote the first three chapters in 3 days, but then he got stuck. He drove out to the LZ Ranch, the last place he'd worked as a cowboy. His old companion, Tom Elze, the inspiration for the rancher, High Loper, was still living there. Elze listened while his friend read, using a different voice for each of the characters. He laughed so hard tears were running down his cheeks, Erickson remembers. He said, "You gotta finish that book." The next day, he went back to his garage and started chapter 4, The Boxer. The chapter includes one of the most iconic scenes of the series in which Hank and Drover taunt another dog, a boxer, by marking his owner's truck tires. Erickson finished what he called Hank the Cow Dog and the Chicken House Murders a while later. As she typically does with Erickson's work, Chris read the draft and gave him feedback. He made edits and then sent the manuscript to a typesetter in Omaha, Nebraska, who suggested he drop "and the Chicken House Murders" from the title. Erickson allowed the cut, and in March 1983, Maverick Book published The Original Adventures of Hank the Cowdog. Take a brief break here to remind you, you're listening to Texas Monthly Magazine on Sight into Sound Broadcasting. This year marks over 50 years of enriching the lives of individuals with visual, physical, and perceptual disabilities. You can listen to Sight into Sound on one of our specially tuned radios, channel 8.5 on TV, streaming on your computer or mobile device, or listening at your convenience on our archives page. We are Sight into Sound Radio since 1967. And now, back to our text. This is the article is about the author, Mr. Erickson, of Hank the Cowdog books. We return now to the text. He published a sequel and then a third Hank book. It took me 15 years of writing to stumble into the Hank story, Erickson says. I was not looking for Hank. When he first began writing Hank stories, he adds, children weren't even the intended audience. That changed when he got a call from the school librarian in the nearby tiny town of Spearman asking him to come read Hank to her elementary students. And I said, I can do the program, but they won't understand the humor. I'm giving my best chops as a writer to these stories. And she says, well, my kids are bringing their parents' books to school and reading them at recess, and they're laughing, and they think they understand the humor. The librarian was right. I enjoyed working with the kids. They laughed at all the right places, Erickson says. Hank had found his market. Several miles southeast of Perryton, Erickson steers his truck off the Tortilla Flat Cap Rock into a sea of grassland. Tall cottonwoods, hackberry trees, and Chinese elms grow in clusters along the banks of a snaking creek. Cattle graze in the pastures on summer yellow grass. It's nearly 3 in the afternoon and warm, but not too hot for Texas in July. Erickson seems perfectly in his element. He points to a house several hundred yards from the road, the LZ Ranch, where he first ended his cowboy career. In the Hank books, he says, when he describes the features of the ranch in Ochiltree County, the actual Texas county that includes Perryton, the house, the yard, the gas tank, the feed barn, machine shed, corrals, and Emerald Pond, the overflow from the septic tank, are all modeled after the LZ Ranch. Every Hank story has a few things in common. They all begin with, it's me again, Hank the Cowdog, and most end with, case closed. Every book comprises 12 chapters. All but the latest volume feature playful black and white sketches by Gerald Holmes, who passed away in 2019. Nikki Early, who works for Maverick Books, has since taken over the illustrations. In addition to Hank and Drover, characters include High Loper and his wife, Sally Mae. The couple has a little boy named Alfred and a baby daughter named Molly. Elsewhere on the ranch, you'll find Cowboy, Slim Chance, High Loper's right-hand man, Pete the Barn Cat, Hank's mortal enemy, naturally, and J.T. Cluck, head rooster. Hank's world is full of critters, coyotes and buzzards, a fiddle-playing fox, a witchy owl, a mean bobcat, and a beautiful collie named Beulah, whom Hank dreams of while snoozing on his gunny sack. Thrumming in the background, just beyond, behind Hank's hijinks, are Erickson's values. Courage, accept accountability, hard work, respect for rural folks and their labor, and a devotion to family. But these are not doled out with a heavy hand. Sometimes Hank learns a valuable lesson. Sometimes he doesn't. The humans in Hank's world do attend church on Sundays, but while Erickson's faith informs everything he writes, he never preaches in his books. Instead, he focuses on spinning a good yarn, one that will make him laugh. People have been laughing at their dogs for 10,000 years, he says. My stories only tell about my little piece of the world, which I've tried to learn as deeply as I can, but they're honest and really funny. Like the real cowdog on which he's based, Hank is constantly getting tangled up in trouble, either because of his boneheadedness or Pete the Barn Cat's scheming. There's almost always some sort of mystery to be solved. To some extent, Hank is a canine parody of Sherlock Holmes, dashed with the swagger of John Wayne and the comedic timing of Laurel and Hardy. Hank is a fountain of malapropisms. He loses track of his thoughts, and he often embellishes his stories to outlandish proportions. But for all his flaws and fleas, when a one-eyed killer stud horse or a hooking bull put someone in danger, Hank bravely charges into battle. And no matter how serious a pickle Hank gets into, he always comes through all right. Because every Hank story also has this in common, a happy ending. The same is not always true of life on a ranch. And 4 years ago, this coming spring, Erickson was standing in the ashes of his little piece of the world with no way of seeing how he might find his own happy ending. On March 6, 2017, strong winds damaged a power line near the Erickson's ranch, sparking the third largest fire in state history. Erickson was no stranger to wildfires. In 2006, he had helped fight another massive blaze that came dangerously close to his place. He had realized then that under dry conditions, the cedars and elms growing in Pickett Canyon could be a death trap. The Ericksons had been lucky that time, but the next time the wind was not in their favor. As smoke nearly blotted out the sun, they fled the canyon with John's two laptops, on which several Hank books were saved, Chris's mandolin, and the clothes on their back. The fire would go on to burn some 318,000 acres across four counties, including 90% of the pastures on the M Cross. A young man died in Lipscomb County, and a separate fire in nearby Gray County killed three people. When Erickson and Chris returned the day after the evacuation, parts of the ranch were still burning. The fields were wastelands of blackened trees and scorched grass. They found the remains of several cattle and a horse, but no trace of their beloved blue heeler, Dixie. Their home was a smoldering wreck of charred wood. There was little to salvage, but in the ash, Erickson found his custom spurs, the word Hank shining in silver against the soot. Friends and neighbors flocked to Erickson's side. They mended fences and delivered feed for the surviving cattle. Soon, word got out to Hank fans. Donations began to stream in from across the country. One boy from southeastern Louisiana persuaded his dad to deliver a flatbed full of hay to the ranch. A girl from Lubbock sent Erickson a $10 gift card to Dairy Queen with a note saying that an M&M blizzard might help Hank feel better. So many letters and packages poured in that 3 years later, Erickson has yet to get through them all. Most wanted to know, did Hank make it? Erickson wasn't sure he had. For several days, he felt disoriented. He was unable to write on his usual schedule. After the fire, I worried that with my life and routines in such a jumbled state, Hank might have gotten lost, and that when I knocked on his door, he might not show up, Erickson later wrote. Even though I have been writing Hank books for 35 years, I have never known if he would answer my knock. Eventually, he forced himself back into his old habits. And then one day he typed those six big words, "It's me again, Hank the cow dog." 1 year after the Perryton blaze, Erickson published a book 71, The Case of the Monster Fire. Hank had answered the knock. First time we spoke on the phone to discuss this story, Erickson was wary. "I don't want to wind up a dead coyote hanging on a fence," he told me. When we meet, he explains his initial hesitation. "I don't want to be part of a snotty little article about an old white guy who goes to church." He says that a conservative cowboy writer like himself has reason to be suspicious of news outlets and entertainment companies, and he has long resisted compromising his principles for opportunities that might have brought him more fame and money. "I always had a stubborn streak," he says. "I think it's natural to people in West Texas. Those who aren't don't get past the first dust storm." Hank's first brush with Hollywood came in May 1985, when CBS created a standalone half-hour cartoon based on the original book, featuring the actor who voiced Captain Kangaroo as the narrator. Erickson was thankful for the national exposure, but he was also troubled by what he saw on the screen. The writers had altered his story in subtle but important ways. For instance, they had omitted the family and turned a cattle ranch into a chicken farm. "I'm lucky that I found a character that people latch onto without having to go through the indignity of having him made into a Saturday morning cartoon series or a television soap opera or something," Erickson says. "I don't know how to explain the popularity of the Hank stories, but I'm very grateful that it turned out that way. I don't know what I did to deserve that gift, but I got it, and it's my job to see that nobody cheapens it." Over the years, Disney came calling, so did Nickelodeon, but Erickson was protective of the rights to Hank. In recent years, Erickson's youngest son, Mark, has taken the reins on Hank adaptations. In 2015, Mark spent several months in New Zealand working with an animation group on a pilot for a Hank series, but they never found a distributor. Then Jeff Nichols came along. The Austin-based screenwriter and director, best known for the critically acclaimed films Take Shelter, Mud, and Loving, took to Hank while reading Book 11, Lost in the Dark, Unchanted Forest, to his five-year-old son. He wrote a podcast script based on the book, and Erickson loved it, calling it warm, funny, faithful to the spirit of the Hank stories, and respectful to our audience, the people who brung us to the dance. In addition to casting Matthew McConaughey as Hank, Nichols gathered a posse of A-listers, including Kirsten Dunst, Cynthia Erivo, Jesse Plemons, and Michael Shannon to voice the other characters in the podcast. Erickson voices Wallace, the buzzard. and humor of the Hank books is what first drew Nichols to the project. I could be reading it to my son, and he's laughing, and I'm laughing too, Nichols says. He cites a scene in Book 11, quoting some lines verbatim, in which Hank and Drover are eating their cheap, dried dog food out of a hubcap. Hank is trying to think, but Drover's loud chomping distracts him. Hank, do you suppose you could be a little quieter and chewing your food?
Drover, well, I don't know, Hank. It's pretty hard.
Hank, of course it is. It's always harder to eat with manners than to eat with the wild abandon of a hog. But who wants to sound like a hog?
Drover, not me.
Hank, hogs make no pretense of being civilized, Drover. They crunch and smack and grunt, and nobody cares because they're only hogs who eat like pigs.
Drover, well, that makes sense.
Hank, but we're not hogs, Drover. We aspire to something higher and better. We try to bring a certain air of dignity to the ritual of eating. The act of imposing dignity on the chaos of experience is called civilization, and protecting civilization has always been hard.
Drover,
yeah, but I meant the colonels were hard.
It just made me laugh, Nichols said, and I thought, there's a real mind here behind us. Despite having fans like Nichols, Erickson hasn't exactly been welcomed by the state's literary elite. He mentions a time when Larry McMurtry, who wrote the foreword for Erickson's 1980 book, Panhandle Cowboy, shrugged him off at a banquet they attended at Tarleton State University. At the time, Larry L. King refused to acknowledge him while they sat at a table together, signing autographs at the Texas Book Festival. But he stopped caring about what the literati thinks of him a long time ago. I made the decision I wanted to hang out with the readers and not writers, he says. Those readers cut a wide cross-section, but Erickson is especially happy that Hank tends to resonate with kids who aren't natural bookworms, just as he wasn't. That's all the legacy a guy should need or want, he says. Now the writer who wanted to be Hemingway is happy to be the guy who writes Hank. He takes his fans and his responsibility to them seriously. I get letters from families who have read the books on the deathbed of a child, he tells me. When you hear that, you need to remove your shoes because you're on holy ground. It probably sounds kind of silly, but it's a bond of trust that we have with our readers. On the simplest level, it's, we'll never give your children anything that's poisonous. That seems to me a reasonable expectation for literature. All of Erickson's other work lives in Hank's shadow, though he has written 25 other books, nonfiction texts, a couple of biographies, a fine West Texas history, and a few novels. This year, he has two nonfiction books coming out with Texas Tech University Press, one about the wildfires and the other about Panhandle archaeology, one of Erickson's passions. By some measures, Erickson has surpassed most of the authors he had once tried to emulate. I don't have any regrets about what I've done. I have a pretty clear conscience. I sleep well at night, he says. So, what a deal. Before I leave the M Cross, Erickson takes me out in his open-top ATV to show me parts of the ranch that are inaccessible by truck. Erickson is behind the wheel. I'm riding shotgun on the bench seat. So is Rosie, who alternates between panting in my ear, drooling on my jeans, and snapping at any soapweed that dares get too close. We drive up steep canyons and descend crumbling embankments of sun-bleached limestone. Turkey vultures circle overhead, and wild plums bloom in red bunches. At one point, as we drive along, Erickson moves to change gears. A praying mantis has taken up residence on the ball of the stick shift. He tries to move the insect to the dash, but the little guy climbs up onto his knuckles instead. Erickson doesn't bother shooing him away. By the time we pull up to the house, Rosie's crawled into his lap, a fly has settled on his shoulder, and two grasshoppers roosted on his pants leg. The mantis is still perched on his hand. He looks like some sort of panhandle Dr. Doolittle, or maybe like Slim Chance, out for a ride with his cow dog. Next up, we'll read something we haven't in a while. This is the restaurant reviews. It's the dining guide, but it's takeout edition. This is edited by Patricia Sharp and Courtney Bond, and it's like your usual restaurant reviews, but this is for stuff that you could take out. And we'll do Houston. Have Better Luck Tomorrow. It's an update of an eclectic place. It's Neighborhood Bar, a collaboration by Justin Yu and Bobby Hugel. It's going strong with a well-curated takeout menu and specials like pasta and salad on Tuesday and steak on Wednesday. Order this to go. The offerings change frequently, though stalwarts like a roasted half chicken, mortadella sandwich, and fried calamari sandwich tend to stay put. The latter isn't the best traveler if you have a ways to go, but it's so good. Calamari crisp and tender, cucumber crunchy, horseradish sprightly, you might not care.
On Tuesday, Supreme Pasta, which is modeled on, tastes just like a Supreme Pizza, was pure spicy comfort. Rigatoni loaded with brick cheese, pepperoni, sausage, and pickled bell peppers. Pro tip, don't pass up on excellent to-go cocktails. Having dutifully tried them all, our favorites are the Pineapple Negroni and the Salty Cat, gin and grapefruit. 544 Yale, 713-802-0845. Butterluck Tomorrow, HOU.com, $2. George's Pasteria, it's an updated Italian place, perhaps the friendliest spot in town. It's an Italian eatery, serves up traditional pastas and pizzas to loyal fans in a warm, old-school kind of space. Portions are generous, the flavor's fresh, and the wine list respectable. Order this to go. Our standard is a brick oven pizza, the margarita in particular. The dough hand-tossed for that one wonderful, chewy, crisp crust, and the sauce, cheese, and toppings judiciously applied. Pastas are reliably good. We're partial to the rigatoni campanolo and mild Italian sausage crumbles in a creamy tomato sauce. George's does seafood quite well, so it's a good option if you live a short drive away or decide to dine in. Case in point, pan-seared redfish topped with sautéed spinach, roasted tomatoes, and sweet shrimp, and a white wine sauce. Sumptuous chicken leek soup is good for, is food for the soul. Pro tip, website menu is a bit clunky but navigable, although orders must be phoned in. During peak hours, parking can be tight, but a couple spaces reserved for takeout. 1722 South Dairy Ashford, 281-558-1717. georgespasteria.com, $3. Next up, Mala Sichuan Bistro. It's an updated Chinese place. The original Chinatown location draws chili heads for tongue-tingling Sichuan peppercorn dishes from an expansive menu. Order this to go. Red chili oil pork dumplings dusted with scallions are a spicy signature, while classic wonton dumplings served in chicken broth are milder. Special fried rice with chicken, shrimp, pork, and beef holds up superbly after traveling and reheating. Ditto the delicious Chengdu-style pot-roasted prawns with asparagus and the gingery stir-fried bok choy. Do the fresh garlic option. Pro tip, online ordering is a snap. Call when you arrive and ask for curbside drop-off or fetch your order inside. 9348 Bel Air Boulevard, 713-995-1889. MalaSichuan.com, $2. Nobis is an update of a new American place. Creative dishes well executed at reasonable prices make Nobis our go-to when we don't want to cook. Order this to go. Rich brie served with fresh honeycomb and mysteriously addictive smoked grapes, all to load on crisp toast, made us happy eaters. Ditto for the ethereal crispy chickpeas with some heat and crunch. At $59, a whole chicken lightly fried and served with black truffle juice, Thai chili vinegar, and an arugula salad with coriander jam. Serves two gluttons or up to four normal people. A nice addition is an order of huge, herby Parker House rolls and sweet, tender Brussels sprouts with an unexpected kick. If you have room, get the fab pistachio pie. Pro tip, there's usually a 10-minute wait at the curb, but it's worth it. 2048 Colquitt, 346-319-5919, NobiSHTX.com, that's N-O-B-I-E, $3. Rosie Cannonball is an update of a new American place. This Montrose hotspot dishes out Euro-American comfort fare with many dishes cooked on its hardwood-burning grill. Expect carbs galore, interesting pizzas and pastas, along with fresh salads and hearty protein-based large plates. Order this to go. Puffy edge pizzas are big on flavor without being overloaded with toppings. Our fennel sausage pizza with Romesco sauce did get a tad soggy on the road, but a piping hot oven at home crisped it right up. Tender chicken bosques with braised tomatoes, chorizo, peppers, and potatoes proved enough for two, and a blistering green bean salad delivered crunch and vibrancy. Pro tip, call when you arrive and they'll tote the food to your car. There are several parking spaces in the small surface lot facing Westheimer. 1620 Westheimer Road, 832-380-2471, rosiecannonball.com, $3. Here's one of my personal favorites here in Houston, Sparkle's Hamburger Spot. It's an update for hamburgers. If you want a crusty, old-time, heavy-duty burger in a chocolate shape, this neighborhood favorite is the place. But wait, there's more. Fried catfish comes jumping with flavor, and the waffles and wings take off. Order this to go. A classic burger loaded with cheese and pickles and hefty hand-cut fries dusted with Cajun spice. Plump breakfast tacos also satisfy. For happy hour, you can get a gallon of daiquiris for $35. Pro tip, parking is limited and the phone often goes unanswered. Order for pickup via orderfood.google.com at 4420 Emancipation Avenue, 713-225-8044, a single dollar sign. State of Grace, it's an update of a southern place. We've missed the elegance of the dining room at this River Oak spot, but still relish the food we ate at our own table. The menu offers the best sort of local fusion. Southern, Gulf Coast, Latin, Asian, all brilliantly executed. Order this to go. We gave top marks to the duck confit, sprinkled with pomegranate seeds and pepitas, and served with a smoky pumpkin seed mole and bitter greens. Root vegetable gratin was ultimately comfortable with its Yukon Gold potatoes, celery root, rutabaga, and a cream sauce. Pro tip, menu is limited to items that travel well. Delicious gratis cream-filled ginger cookies were dropped into our bag with a wave and a smile. 3258 Westheimer Road, 832-942-5080, stateofgracetx.com, and $3 signs. Tiny Champions is a new Italian place. It's new from the folks at the lauded Nancy's Hustle. Tiny Champions is another East Side winner. Menu is short but imaginative, and the food soul-satisfying. Prices are right. Most dishes hold up en route. Order this to go. What sounded like a ho-hum starter, the thinly shaved mushrooms, turn out to be slivers of cremini with olive oil, a shot of lemon and black pepper, and a snowfall of Parmesan. Simply delish. More hearty are the five smoky fried mozzarella balls, creamy inside and crusty outside, served with marinara sauce. We soldiered on with the perfectly al dente mortadella tortellini, bathed in lemon butter with a topping of pistachios. Our sausage and pepper pizza with fresh basil scattered on top had a bit too much char for us, but otherwise tasted fine. A pro tip, order online and arrive a little early for pickup, as parking can be tricky. It's at 3617 McKinney, 713-485-5329, tinychampionshouston.com, $3 sign. And lastly, Traveler's Table. This is an update of a new American place. This Globetrotters special is impressively international. Expect satisfying renditions of Italian, Indian, Japanese, Chinese, Latin, and Middle Eastern dishes to eat at the partially open-air restaurant or to pick up. Order this to go. Good options include very fresh raw tuna lined up on beds of chewy sushi rice and spiked with peppers and ginger. Fabulous steamed vegetable dumplings with shiitakes, chilies, and soy, touched with garlic and cilantro. Spicy cumin lamb served with dry fried and overly salted green beans. Crab-filled samosas with a flaky curried pastry and luscious mango chutney. And the truffled margarita flatbread, which can be crisped up if necessary in the oven. Pro tip, order online or by phone. A valet will direct you at pickup. 520 Westheimer Road, 832-409-5785, TravelersTable.com on the net, and $3 signs. And being close by, we'll include the island city, Galveston, in today's reading, and their contribution to the takeout menu in Galveston is Fish Company Taco. It's an update of a seafood place. This humble Gulf-to-Table eatery offers a concise menu of tacos in imaginative styles like Baja, Crema, Mexipickle, Cilantro, and Empire, ginger garlic Hunan sauce, and green onions, all of which can be filled with the day's fresh catch, Gulf shrimp, or vegetables. Order this to go. Chef Daya's special, no matter what it is, think fried snapper banh mi or Filipino-style rice noodle soup with blue crab claw and grilled amberjack. Then go ahead and add any of the five tacos, or all of them, plus the ethereal tempura onion rings and the sticky, salty chili shrimp, bathed in a coffee fish caramel studded with crunchy peanuts. Pro tip, here's an actual tip for pros. Unemployed hospitality staff eat for free. At 1914 23rd, call first, 409-220-3245. And on the net at fishcotaco.com. And to close out today's reading, we'll hit Meanwhile in Texas from the state section. Two male Gen 2 penguins at SeaWorld San Antonio incubated a chinstrap penguin's egg and have cared for the chick as their own since it hatched. Houston police rescued a suspected thief who was experiencing hypothermia after he led them on a chase, crashed his car, and jumped into Buffalo Bayou. 17-year-old girl from Kingwood earns a bachelor's degree in psychology from the University of Houston and immediately made plans to enroll in the master's program in education. After a woman allegedly stole a $10,000 bulldog from a pet shop outside Aldine, An employee ran after her, jumped onto the hood of her car, and hung on for a mile as she sped away. The woman was arrested, but the dog was not recovered. When each of its two candidates received exactly 1,010 votes, Dickinson chose its mayor by pulling a name out of a hat. A man in Odessa allegedly stole an 18-wheeler and accidentally crashed it into another 18-wheeler before fleeing the scene. Some Austin area residents wondered if they'd seen a ghost after they viewed home security footage of an unidentified individual in a long gown wandering the neighborhood at 2 o'clock in the morning, only to learn that the figure was a corporeal woman walking home after a late-night car accident. That was all put together by Sierra Juarez, and it brings us to the end of our reading for today. You're listening to Texas Monthly Magazine, Saturday afternoons at 5 and Monday afternoons at 2. Sight in the Sound Broadcasting.
Next, on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Travelin' Texas, followed by Texas Gardener at 4:30.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas Community Update.
The Midland Health Department is providing clinical services by appointment only. Appointments will be scheduled from 8:15 a.m. to 3:45 p.m., Monday through Friday. In addition, the Health Department will have an immunization clinic, 8:15 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday. Appointments are required for immunizations. To schedule an appointment, call 681-7613.
The Permian Basin is currently experiencing an unprecedented slowdown because of lower demand and an escalation in foreign production of oil. To keep current, we bring you the weekly Business and Oil Report. Each week, Recording Library volunteers and staff read the Midland Reporter Telegram and Odessa American Business and Oil pages. Friday mornings at 6 and repeated Sunday nights at 7 and Thursdays at 4 a.m. on Recording Library of West Texas Radio. Read by listening.
With a little love, we can lay it down.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 62 and clear. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low in the low 40s. Then tomorrow, cloudy with a high in the mid-40s. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with a low in the mid-30s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 4 p.m.
Hello and welcome to our program. My name is Lynette McGlamory, and I'll be reading Travelin' Texas here on Sight Into Sound Radio. For today's program, I'll be reading articles from the Texas Highways website, and our first one is titled, For the Best Enchiladas in Texas, Go Back to School in San Antonio. To make the classic Tex-Mex dish, follow the recipe based on the one served in school cafeterias since the 1950s, written by John Nova Lomax. On the list of dishes Texans love to eat and argue about, cheese enchiladas exist somewhere near the top, perhaps trailing only beef brisket and chili con carne. There are heated debates over recipes, such as what tortillas to use, which type of cheese, and whether or not to include onions. The eminently sensible and correct consensus is that you must use corn tortillas and American cheese and sprinkle the gooey fresh from the oven enchiladas with diced white onion. To the certain number of crazy people who don't, bless your hearts. The debate also rages over where you can find the best cheese enchiladas in Texas. When on this trail, you look for a Tex-Mex restaurant of a certain vintage, the older the better. Dallas's El Phoenix, Larry's in Richmond, and Matt's El Rancho in Austin fit the bill. Then there are the old-school, small-town family restaurants, or greasy spoons that feature a couple of Tex-Mex dishes, alongside other Texan comfort foods, like Houston's Spanish Village, my favorite, Bandera's Old Spanish Trail, and Austin's Texas Chili Parlor. But for a certain number of Alamo City natives, despite their hometown having a multitude of contenders for best enchiladas in the state, like the Blanco Cafe, Los Barrios Cafe, and Chocola Mexican Restaurant, to name a few, the consensus among at least some residents is there are no cheese enchiladas better than those you got at lunch every Wednesday in San Antonio's public schools. That's right. It's quite possible that the best cheese enchiladas on the planet are school cafeteria food. I was made aware of this theory via a post at surlyhorns.com, a message board community loosely affiliated with former University of Texas at Austin students and Longhorn sports fans. Here's a portion of what the anonymous poster, who declined to comment for the story, wrote. If you didn't grow up in San Antonio, I can't explain the cultural significance of Enchilada Day, aka Wednesday. The enchiladas were so good, they would actually chart increased school attendance on Enchilada Day. When the lunch bell rang, there would be a mad dash to the cafeteria, because the line would be out the expletive door, and you ran the risk of them either running out or you're not having enough time to eat. One kid broke his arm running toward the cafeteria on Enchilada Day when he put his hand through the plate glass window on the door, trying to push it open. I'm pretty sure he still tried to get in line before going to the nurse. Whoa, could this be true? The best cheese enchiladas on the planet were served at San Antonio school lunches? I called around and crowdsourced on social media, asking people who attended San Antonio public schools what Enchilada Day meant to them. It became quite clear that these enchiladas make quite an impression. The phenomenon started in the 1950s and continues today, particularly in the city's Northeast Independent School District, where enchiladas remain in the menu rotation. The races to the cafeteria were amazing, says Dr. Richard Middleton, a graduate and former superintendent of San Antonio's Northeast ISD. At our 50th high school reunion, people were talking about how if there was one thing they wish they could relive, a lot of them said Enchilada Day. Every Wednesday, Pat Wendt, a graduate of Highlands High School in the San Antonio Independent School District, said via email. Two Ethryl cheese enchiladas, rice and beans, not refried, and chocolate cake, 35 cents. People came in off the street to eat on Wednesdays. Middleton used to bring an extra nickel just to get a third enchilada. They were that good. I would take them over anyone else's, says Rose Stevens, a graduate from and then a teacher in San Antonio's Northeast ISD. They are so tender and creamy and so perfect. I'm San Antonio born and raised, and while I am as Anglo as they come, I know my Mexican food. Though retired, Stevens still volunteers and takes substitute shifts for pay. One shift recently came to an end when she needed an operation that required a substitute teacher to take over for her. When he called me, he said he was sad I was returning to school on a Wednesday, which meant he would miss enchilada day. That was all he wanted to talk about. And here I was, wanting to talk about my class, she says, laughing. According to Sharon Glasson, executive director of school nutrition for Northeast ISD, when San Antonio schools started restricting access due to COVID-19, parents wanted to know if they could still come visit on enchilada day. As for Jose Ricardo Valdez, a former Northeast ISD student, he believes they exist on a whole other level. Best enchiladas ever, he proclaims. They are uniquely delicious and don't really compare to restaurant enchiladas. Maybe it's the cheese? He, like a number of students from Northeast ISD, also remembers cornbread as a key component of the meal. The cornbread was great to soak up all the gravy, he says. It was a hearty lunch, and probably nap time afterwards. In saying it was all about the cheese, Valdez may be onto something. Middleton recalls enchiladas were already entrenched on San Antonio school lunch menus in 1960, when he started attending those schools. According to him, a woman named Laverl Billingsley, the longtime manager of Northeast ISD's school kitchens, added them to the district's menu in the 1950s, probably to take advantage of cheap, subsidized American cheese, read government cheese. Thanks to its meltiness, it just so happens to be the perfect cheese for enchiladas. And so, recognizing the love San Antonians had already for cheese enchiladas, Billingsley made it a Wednesday staple, trusting the cooks in the district's kitchen to come up with the recipe for the sauce and the chili gravy on top, which they did. I attempted to make